Welcome to episode number 271 of Film Wax Radio, the independent film podcast. How are you doing? You know, it's so normal to ask the void, you know, how you're doing. But the truth is, of course, since you have no way of responding in real time, I'm not even sure why I would ask. But let me rephrase. I hope you're doing well. I hope you're holding up. If you're in the Northeast, we've had a real winter. Of course, the news industry has to find stories even where they don't exist. We get great news, I suppose, but we recognize at this stage that equal time is given to stories along the lines of ISIS and what's going on, you know, in the Middle East, as well as what's going on with Bruce Jenner. But that's just the world we live in at the moment, so be it. But what I sometimes get a little annoyed at how the weather is reported. Everybody knows a couple weeks ago we were supposed to get this the biggest snowstorm on record, right? In the history of recorded weather. You know, it's not that we didn't get that. You know, it's good, right? And they took all the precautionary measures in order to avoid disasters. Nobody died. I don't know. I mean, I assume the homeless people were taken care of. I don't know. It was reported that we were going to get somewhere around as little as 3 feet of snow, maybe, you know, more. I don't know. Just in a huge amount of snow was going to be dumped on the earth. What we got was about 4 inches of snow. They tried to exaggerate that in certain parts. It was more, but truth of the matter is, it was just an average snowfall for late January, you know. Anyway, so it's just really the amount of alarmist broadcasting that I object to. You know, it just has an ill effect in a very real way, not so subtle either. I mean, I think people just get very strikingly anxious about weather more than they need to. So that's what's going on in New York in terms of the weather. I don't know how I got off on that tangent. It's just something that ruffled my feathers a bit, and I'm a little bit frustrated by that. So here we are in New York City. You know what? I have a very nice experience yesterday. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but I do these occasional TV appearances where I interview filmmakers. It's been a great experience to do this, and I've been really just sort of starting to get comfortable in front of the camera. And, you know, it's not just that you're on camera. It's live. There's a teleprompter. There's a producer talking into your earpiece. You know, just things like that. Nothing major. I mean, it's all in all pretty fun. I spoke to Jody Lee Lipes yesterday, the filmmaker who is, he's done a lot of cinematography. He shot After School. He shot Martha Marcy May. I know I screwed it up. He shot, he shoots for those Borderline guys. He shoots for Lena Dunham. He shot Tiny Furniture and a couple of seasons of Girls. He's even directed, I think, an episode or more of that show. And now he just is premiering his second documentary. It's called Ballet 422. And it's opening tomorrow. And it's basically the story about one of the dancers in the company. His name is Justin Peck. He has been choreographing dances for the New York City Ballet. And this was this film follows basically the artistic trajectory of that project and from conception to launch of the actual dance. I think last night Justin just launched his seventh dance called Rodeo for the New York City Ballet. So he's still a young guy. He may still even be in his 20s, which is absurd. Anyway, the film again, Jody Lee Lipes is the director. It's called Ballet 422, and it opens Friday, February 6th, here in New York City at Lincoln Center. And down at the Landmark Sunshine on East Houston. And then it's going to open in L.A. and I think San Francisco next Friday, the 13th. And so I'm just going to put that out there. Thank you, Jody, for sitting with me. You can go to BK Live's website. It's on the Brooklyn Independent Media. Just Google it, BK Live, and should come up. You can see that video. And it's also, I posted it on my personal Facebook page. But I'm kind of proud of the work, and I'm hoping to do more of it. And the other thing I wanted to mention before we go into the show is that I was once again bawled over that I had a very nice mention about the podcast on TribecaFilm.com the other day. I think this was Tuesday. Somebody, a friend of mine, sent me the link, said very nice. I had no idea that it was happening, much like the IndieWire piece about a month or two ago where I was mentioned, or Film Wax Radio was mentioned. And then again, Tribeca put up a list of 5 podcasts and top of the line right there, at number one. I couldn't have been more... Wow, just humbled and yet so happy to see that the recognition. It means a lot, because a lot of people in the film world see that kind of thing and take it seriously. So hopefully we're finding an audience. Been doing the podcast now going off, 3 or 4 years. probably not quite that long. Film Wax Radio did start as an internet radio show. I thought I saw, for what I do, mind you, not for other people, but for what this show was about, it probably would make more sense to put it on a podcast than put it continue it on internet radio. But maybe at some point I will go back to radio. That would be kind of exciting. But at the moment, this is the way it is, and I'm very happy with the growth. So thank you. We're going to go into the show number 271 right now. It is Black History Month. This episode happens to be sponsored by Real Works Teenage Filmmaking. It is that organization that I'm happy to work with. They are mentoring and teaching high school children how to make documentary films every Friday, or almost every Friday night. They have a screening. It's free and open to the public. And one film they're showing tomorrow night, Friday, is Samantha Knowles, or she goes by Sam Knowles, Why Do You Have Black Dolls? It's a short film, and Sam will be at Real Works tomorrow to introduce her film and maybe to do Q&A. They are at 540 President Street in Brooklyn. You can check out the realworks.org website and get all the details. They're also on Facebook. I'm proud to be associated with this organization. I'm proud to have Sam on the show. In my goal to have a more diverse podcast, I'm happy to have Sam on, but just, it's a tricky thing. I'm just looking to have people on that I want to talk to. I try to keep in mind that the show should reflect the world of cinema out there, and that requires a certain amount of fortitude. It requires a certain amount of thinking about it, and it requires a certain amount of acting on it. If you want a diverse show, it requires activity on my part. So since I booked the show, that's something I have to do a better job of. So, that's the best way I can put it. This first segment is with this young filmmaker named Sam Knowles, and she does have this documentary short called Why Do You Have Black Dolls? The guest after that is, he is a performer, an actor, a playwright, now film historian we can add to the list. He's a drag artist. Charles Bush is a New Yorker. He definitely channels the Hollywood actresses of the past. And you can see that in his movie roles. Charles is probably best known for appearing in Psycho Beach Party and Die Mommy Die. But he is a very, very versatile guy and is involved in a lot of projects. One of them is a show called Here's to the Girls, Hollywood's Leading Ladies, which is going to be a part of the 92nd Street Wise series. Lyrics and Lyricists. This is an ongoing series, apparently been going on for decades, I believe, at the 92nd Street Y up on Lexington Avenue and 92nd Street, of all places. All weekend coming up, there is going to be a series of these shows, which are going to have live music and comedy, and Charles Bush, who is a really funny guy, he's going to be there to host. And I understand that TMC's own Robert Osborne is going to be there. And you know what? I love Charles Bush, and I had a great time talking to him. And he's, again, that's coming up. I really also want to get Robert Osborne on. What a guy. Wouldn't that be a great fun to have him on the show? I feel like I can do this. So I'm going on Sunday to see Charles in this wonderful production, and I am going to try to meet up with Robert Osborne and just sort of, ambush him and get him to commit to coming on the podcast. He can even bring Drew Barrymore if he likes, but I want Robert Osborne on the show. Wouldn't that be fun? Last up are my friends, director George Manitos, actress Alexandra Clayton, and via Skype, actor Christopher Lankenau. George Manitos did a short called Benny to Benny a couple of years ago. When I was hosting a theatrical engagement of another film called Northeast, I also showed a series of shorts. I included George's short. And Chris came, and George came, and we had a great night. Now George has a feature film called Red Right Return. Christopher Lankenau is in it. The lovely Alexandra Clayton is in it. And also, the lovely Arnold Tuchel is even in it. But he is not in this conversation. I should have invited him, but I did not. And I realize what a mistake that is. But the good news is we do have, in this coming segment, number three here, a George Manitos, who directed the film, and actors Alexandra Clayton and Christopher Lankenau. Indeed, if you're a big indie film fan, you may remember Christopher from his appearing in two Aaron Katz films. He was in Quiet City and he was in Cold Weather. Both are great films. And now he's in another great film called Red Right Return. Just had a screening at Film Anthology Archives, which was had a great turnout and was a great experience. We're trying to find more platforms for people to see this film, whether it be in theaters and digital. So we spoke to these guys about this film, making it, what it was like, and also getting it out there in the world and what that experience is like. It's the challenges and the rewards of doing that. So those guys are going to be up last. So let's go right into now my conversation with the filmmaker Sam Knowles and her short documentary. Again, it's called Why Do You Have Black Dolls?
We normally say dolls have a story to tell. I love the images that they represent, and I love the facial features.
I love black dolls. It's not like selling jewelry. You look at earrings, you go, oh, no, this is a conversation. This is a life.
Black dolls have been around for as long as humans have been around. And the history is important because long after you have vanished, then the history still remains.
I make black dolls for simply because I'm black. You know, it's funny, your customers too have a lot of influence. They actually tell you, where's the big girl? So I started making big bone dolls. Well, where's the sisters with the boots? So here's the sister with funky hair and boots.
I have black dolls because they're a reflection of me and my people. At the end of the day, what matters to me is that we embrace our cultural heritage and understand its pivotal role in making us who we are.
See, I think women know they're beautiful, but when you see a doll, that's signature. Yes, I know I am, because someone had enough thought to create this. That's what it's about. It's about loving who you are.
Sam Knowles, Why Do You Have Black Dolls is the name of the film.
Yes.
Why Do You Have Black Dolls? It's a short. Tell us about what it's about. And then we'll get more into the subtext of the film. I thought it was really moving and really had a lot of power to it, a lot of power in there, you know?
Thank you.
Yeah, and especially because it's only 20-something minutes. So, yeah.
So basically the film is just kind of about this, like, this community of black doll creators, artists, and collectors.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of picks a few people from the community. It's a pretty large community and pretty tight-knit.
Is it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, relative to other communities who are passionate about one thing, it's smaller than, you know, a community of like Trekkies or something.
second to Trekkies are the black doll makers and collectors.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I think what I didn't realize is that, you know, going in, I assumed it was a lot smaller than it actually is.
Uh-huh.
But so basically I kind of pick a few people from the community and I follow them,
right.
And interview them about why they collect black dolls or why they're passionate about black dolls. And mm-hmm. the reason why I did that, and it's discussed briefly in the film, is that when I was, you know, around 8 years old, I had a friend who asked me, why do you have black dolls? She came over.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in a community that was like largely white,
mm-hmm.
In upstate New York. And she came over, and I had all black dolls, and she had never seen that. And she was like, why do you have black dolls? And I can't remember what I said to her in that moment, but it was years later in college. I was talking about it with a friend, and I brought that
mm-hmm.
I brought that up.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, what? You know, my friend was kind of like,
sure.
That's crazy.
Right. Well, the same reason you have black dolls is the same reason why it stuck with you and why you remember it, because it goes to the very core of your identity. Why you would have black dolls and the whole issue of loving oneself, of self-image, of all that, right? Which is really what the film is about. And the black dolls and the collecting thereof is really more on the kind of a superficial or on the outside of that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which
definitely.
Which it's interesting because you're, you know, of the community, as you put it, of black doll collectors or makers, both.
Both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That number of them... touch upon that about that, and I mean, and with you can't talk about that aspect of self-love and of why they're so important on an emotional level or the psychological level without also talking about how for so many centuries there were no black dolls and black people were basically invisible in and your only option was to have white dolls, and on some level that must have been very scarring just to have that happen. Nobody talked about it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's really important, a really important part of the film, too, because mm-hmm. the fact that the community even exists is sort of a response to that lack. And that's why I was really intrigued when I found them, because I set out to make a film about black dolls, and I had no idea what it was going to be about. I just knew that I wanted to address it. So when I realized that this community existed, I thought, like, what an interesting way to talk about self-image, because this community is trying to kind of make that happen themselves. They don't find it in stores largely, so they create it. They just create it. And it's kind of amazing. And even though there's this whole, you know, now it's a lot easier to get black dolls than it was maybe, you know, 50 years ago. But it's
Or five years ago.
I mean, when I was younger, when I was growing up, like 15 years ago, my mom used to say that she had to make special requests.
Oh, special order them.
Yeah.
Or, gotcha. Right. Yeah.
Especially at Christmas. So yeah, it's, you know, it's,
She's a good mom, sounds like.
Yeah, she's pretty good.
Well, it seems like she was really tapped into this and really was and realized how important it was when it, especially because there wasn't so as quite as much conversation around. There was, but not in a very large way, a conversation about this issue. And she's prioritizing getting you dolls that reflect who you are and saying black women are beautiful, you know, and we're no more is visibility, no more. And I also like that people said, well, we're not waiting for the toy companies to catch up. They're obviously, you know, they're out of step. We'll do it. We'll just do it, you know, and then they get the added benefit of actually making beautiful art out of it, you know, right? So all that is in that film. Where did you learn how to make films?
I went to Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. And
a lot of African Americans at Dartmouth, I understand. Being sarcastic.
yeah, there's a few of us.
Yeah.
And they don't, you know, Dartmouth has a film program, but it's more sort of geared toward film studies as opposed to
like history and theory rather. Yeah.
And there's a production component, but it's not a humongous production component. And all my roommates are NYU students, which is why I really feel they're NYU grads, which is why I really feel the difference between film school and, you know,
sure.
Film
studies program. Well, it's one extreme to the other.
Yeah, absolutely.
And NYU is not an Ivy League school, but just for the record, you went to one.
But the good thing was that Dartmouth, because they didn't necessarily have like a humongous film production component, they really gave me a lot of freedom to explore.
Right.
And they were very supportive of the project, and I reached my funding goal all through grants at Dartmouth. Mm-hmm. I had two really great professors who were my advisors on the project, and they were very supportive, and they still are very supportive of the film.
It seems like an ideal topic for getting grants too.
Yeah,
because it just seems to meet every button. You know, it's about a social theme. It's about social relevant theme. It's about art. It's about community, you know, it's, you know, so that's all working to your advantage.
Yeah. It was great. And it was actually, I made the film at Dartmouth.
Mm-hmm.
It was my senior honors thesis. And so that kind of helped it too, because they're looking for projects that are a little different.
Mm-hmm.
So that was great.
Well, how did you get introduced to RealWorks?
I heard about RealWorks years ago when I was actually doing research for the film, and I live in Brooklyn, so I kind of know about all of the Brooklyn film venues.
I bet.
And then they got in touch with me a few weeks ago, and they were like, we want to screen the film during Black History Month. That's a month when, like, I get more requests for screenings, understandably.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Makes sense.
But those other 11 months, not so much.
but a lot during Black History Month, which is... Right,
and I'm glad for the opportunity to meet you and that it all came together because of that. That's fine with me. They're sponsoring this episode, and so, you know, I always try to – it's an opportunity to get behind them again because they do such great, great work. And, you know, they work with the high schoolers and give them these great opportunities to learn how to make films, to mentor them. It's all great. You know, they do really great work. You should think about doing that, mentoring.
Since
you're so close to it.
Yeah, I sort of do it informally sometimes.
Right, yeah.
But it's fun.
Well, here you can do it formally and not get paid also, but do it more formally. And so where did you grow up?
I grew up in a small town in...
Upstate New York, is that
Upstate New York, in Orange County. There's an Orange County in New York.
Uh-huh.
In Warwick. It's about an hour north...
The Catskills? Or?
Northwest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like, again, very supportive parents.
Very supportive,
And really pushed you, like, to do... do great things. Because then you went to Dartmouth, which is a terrific school up in Hanover.
Up in Hanover, yes.
I know where it is. I've been there many, many, many times. Why do you have Black Dolls, which we've been talking about, and which we're going to show Real Works on February the 13th.
Yeah.
Friday the 13th. So come on out and meet Sam and to see the film. It's really nice to meet you. And I urge everybody to come out and check out your film.
Yeah, it'll be fun. Come out.
Thanks. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
Again, for you folks who are interested and you find yourself in Park Slope or anywhere in Brooklyn, New York City area, and you want to go check out Real Works and ask and find out all the information. They usually show a short by one of the kids. They're always good, by the way. And then they show the film of the night. And it can be almost any movie. But in this case, I know they're showing this short. So you can meet Sam in person. And again, that's at 540 President Street. That's between 3rd and 4th Avenues in Park Slope, Brooklyn. Okay, so Charles Bush, again, this series, Here's to the Girls, Hollywood's Leading Ladies. You want to have a good time. It's going to be at the 92nd Street Y. They're doing a bunch of performances of the show. I'm going to read this to you. Let's see. You can go to the 92ndStreetY.org, of course, under their events section, and, of course, find out for yourself. I will be there on Sunday. That's the plan. But there are going to be performances at Saturday, February 7th, at 8 o'clock in the evening, at Sunday at 2 o'clock, and at 7 o'clock on Sunday. And then again on Monday, it's going to be there also at 2 o'clock and at 7:30 p.m. So you have a nice long weekend full of these opportunities to see Here's to the Girls, Hollywood's Leading Ladies. Again, Charles Bush will be there, and Robert Osborne is a special guest also. So go check it out. And here's my conversation with Charles Bush. Oh,
I don't
my
see
God.
You.
You're such a narcissist.
I don't see me. I don't see me.
We're only working, I guess, through audio at the moment, but that's okay.
All right. Okay.
We'll try to figure it out before we say goodbye.
And, all right.
But I'm going to come to one of the shows anyway, and I'm going to introduce myself afterwards. I'll come up and I'll do the classic thing. I'll wait at the stage door with my program anxiously awaiting for you to emerge from the theater.
Okay. Well, you have to fight through all the elderly Jews.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to consider myself one in the making.
I don't know. I think this is off the record, but I think their subscriber base is more like in the three digits.
It's very – it might be. But
yeah, that's off the record, dude.
Yeah, no, of course, that's off the record, of course. Although the off the record, of course, is the stuff of, often the most entertaining. In that DNA, somewhere in the buried and though in their DNA is this love of the musical theater and of old Hollywood, no?
Of the audience, yes. Well, it's gone on for decades. This series. I remember, I never didn't go at those early ones, but at the time, the great songwriters were still alive, weren't they? So when they would do Sammy Kahn and it really was an evening with those people. Of course, as the decades have gone by, it's turned into something quite different. But I've only really attended a couple of them, which I've enjoyed.
But you're talking, of course, about Lyrics and Lyricists.
Lyrics and Lyricists series. Yeah, but they came to my frequent collaborator, director Carl Andrus, and I about creating something for them. And he'd directed A Comet in Green Evening about a year ago, which was very successful. So they came to us. And so it's kind of fun. We were trying to think of something that would be that we really were interested in. And I'm not really an expert on the Great American Songbook as much as I really had a, I've had a life sort of devoted to studying classic film.
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of a way of bringing it more into my field of expertise.
Right, right. Well, yeah, already, it's as though you anticipated my first question, Charles. You answered my first question, which was how this sort of came about. But I want to take one step back, since you brought it up, about you're a film historian in addition to being obviously a playwright and an actor. And
right.
I wondered...
Floor sweeper.
whatever it takes, I understand.
Yes.
And you may be back to that, you know, in February when this comes about. But how did you originally... it's probably a long story, but maybe you can encapsulate it a little. How did you originally fall in love with classic cinema?
Well, I've only very recently sort of come out as a, as a film historian. I used to be quite embarrassed about it. I remember the first time I was interviewed for a documentary on, I think it was Joan Crawford.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw the actual documentary that, you know, they under my name, you know, to identify you on camera. It's a Charles Bush actor, playwright, Crawford historian.
Crawford historian.
And I was kind of embarrassed in a way because I thought, you know, I'm not really a historian. I've just, you know, seen a lot of movies and read the same books as everybody else has. But I'm trying to own it now that I guess at a certain point, you know, where is the line between
Buff or
historian?
Yeah, I think it's the number of hours you log in watching TCM. Like, if you've watched 1,000 hours of TCM, that automatically you just become a film historian.
I guess. Well, I've been a talking head on so many things. I get worried that next time I show up, somebody's going to say, "Oh, just shut up."
Never.
There's him blathering on again. Yeah, because I'm part of the. You know, they say that I'm part of the TCM family. Mm-hmm. Which is awfully nice to belong in.
Are you like a goddaughter?
As Mae West would say, I'm the red leaf on the family tree.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, I mean, I was even invited to the their film festival last year where I became acquainted with my new friend, Kim Novak.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, which was pretty damn cool.
Well, first of all, thank you for being a talking head on my little thing here.
Okay.
I don't get enough opportunities to focus on classic cinema.
Everybody always calls it, you know, an interest in old movies. And I noticed on TCM, actually, they referred to it as classic film. And I've been actually saying that now.
Yeah.
Because it becomes something of old movies is a bit of a pejorative and a little patronizing, isn't it?
You're right. It is. I like and really, I mean, the beauty of it all, though, when you get down to it, good movies are just good movies. And yeah. I don't think it matters when they're made or by whom or from where. It's just entertainment is what it is at the end of the day. So,
yes.
So to get back to the events coming up in February at the 92nd Street Y, again, it's part of this ongoing series that they've been doing, I guess, as you said, for quite a number of years.
Oh, didn't it begin maybe in the early 70s? I'm just making that up, but I would think.
Let's make it up then, because
I'm not sure. That sounds good.
Yeah. It actually started with like the Comdens and Green, yes. and the Hal Kantners and all these other legends. And of course, as they've passed on, they're reinventing kind of what the series is about, but keeping it in the tradition again of.
Really a devotion to what's referred to as the Great American Songbook. Kind of a commitment to that.
Great. You and your as you said, your professional partner, Carl Andrus, have written a show called Here's to the Girls, Hollywood's Leading Ladies.
Mm-hmm.
And this, it does seem like something that is in your wheelhouse.
Oh, yes, I certainly had a career. So much of my work has been referencing the pantheon of great female stars. Generally, it's been dramatic stars, you know, Betty Davis and Norma Shearer and Rosalind Russell. So this is somewhat different for me because we're celebrating the women of the Hollywood musical. And, you know, it's an interesting thing because, you know, I was trying to think of the great male stars, and there certainly were, you know, Fred Astaire, Gene Kelly, Frank Sinatra, Donald O'Connor, and then you start, there aren't that many when you really think about it, you know,
right.
Dan Bailey, yeah. You know, you really, Howard Keel, but, you know, it's kind of hard, but when you think about the women stars in Hollywood musicals going from 1930 through 1960, I mean, there are a lot. And yes. We had a hard time actually trying to focus on, you know, and creating some kind of parameters and for on the subject. Do we maybe just narrow the field a little bit, you know? So we chose not to focus on any Broadway adaptations, but just original movie musicals.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And then the other thing we decided to do, which I think is kind of interesting, rather than approaching it chronologically and just starting from, you know, the early talkies, going through, you know, what could be perceived as, you know, the kind of end of the golden era in 1960, maybe with Gigi, let's say. We thought it'd be fun to go from studio to studio.
Yes.
Because I do find it interesting. I mean, I'm not the first one to come up with this theory, you know. I've just read so many books, but the idea that each major Hollywood studio had their own house style. And I do find it interesting that since really almost all of them were founded by European Jewish immigrants, a case can be made that the house style of each studio was influenced by what the immigrant experience was for that particular person. For instance, Louis B. Mayer, who founded MGM, which was the most powerful of the Hollywood studios, you know, had a rather really traumatic early childhood in Russia. And so his reaction in a way was to wipe it all out and to really create a kind of fake Americana in the MGM product of Andy Hardy and the, you know, picket fence America, or the most glamorous, luxuriant, elegant fantasy. And the women generally, you know, there's always exceptions to every rule, but generally the female stars that came out of MGM exuded a kind of elegant, wholesome, all-American goddess quality.
Right.
So, you know, there's the young Judy Garland and Jane Powell and June Allison. And whereas opposed to Warner Brothers, the four Warner Brothers actually came to the United States from Eastern Europe at a very, very young age. In fact, Jack Warner, the youngest brother, was born when they already were here. And they grew up in a real hardscrabble, urban American environment. You know, there was a lot of social protest in the environment they grew up in, and consequently, you know, the Warner Brothers movies, particularly in the early 30s, really reflected that, and they were kind of real tough urban melodramas. Huh. And when they started doing musicals like 42nd Street or Gold Diggers of 1933, those movies really were kind of like in the style of those early gangster films, but with these fabulous Busby Berkeley musical numbers stuck in.
Right, just for great measure, yeah.
Yes, and then the kind of women who they required then had a kind of a tough urban quality, the young Ruby Keeler, Joan Blondell.
Understood. That's interesting.
So yeah, it's interesting. You know, so that's how we're approaching it, from studio to studio, and from the way that the immigrant experience influenced the house style.
Oh, sure, sure. Well, this sounds exactly like the kind of stuff you might be talking about with Robert Osborne after the... I assume you'll have Q&As afterwards with him?
Oh, well, no, actually...
how's that working out?
Robert, you know, he's a good friend of mine, and we're so thrilled he's actually going to be on the show. And he is kind of a special guest. Often they have a special guest who's usually, another musical performer from an older generation. You know, we have a lot of music going on to chart this from 1930 to 1960, and we have five wonderful young women who are the singers, and I'm the... host MC.
Sure.
So actually, I think it's going to be really great having Robert come on, and just I'll do a little interview with him on stage. And he knew so many of these women, you know, late in their life,
yes.
You know, and either interviewed them or knew them socially. And so it's going to be kind of fun, I think, to get Bob to tell, you know, his wonderful anecdotes about his personal experiences with these women.
Oh, that's great. And those women you referred to are going to be performing, or they're probably going to have a blast.
We have a lot of different medleys. It's going to be moving, yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
And I don't think they're really going to be playing those ladies. I think they'll just be interpreting the wonderful songs that, you know, the
yes.
You know, catalog of great composers wrote specifically for these movies.
But it sounds like a lot of fun.
Because it really is. It's kind of, it's a musical review with a historical context. And, you know, they may portray me as a historian, but you know, I'm really an entertainer, so I'm going to try to make my narration very conversational, and it's a fun way for me to share so many of the quotations and anecdotes that I've picked up from a lifetime of reading, you know, books on Hollywood.
Doing your homework.
You know, I've been doing my homework for about, you know, 50 years. So it's about time I share some of it with you know, my audience.
Now I'm curious. Did you grow up in New York?
Yeah.
So
yeah, New York City. I am a lifelong New Yorker.
Very good.
There's only been a couple years where I didn't live here. I went to Northwestern University, you know, in the Midwest, in Chicago, and then kind of lived there for two more years, then came back to New York. And since my career's been in the theater, I really had to be here, and my family are very close to. So yeah, I've just never left.
Very good. And so it would not be surprising that you were into theater and into, you know, film from a very young age then.
Really raised by my aunt, my mother's sister, and she, you know, shared all my cultural interests. And she was, you know, a little bit of an anti-Mame, I guess you'd say, and started taking me to the theater when I was about 8 years old.
Isn't that fantastic?
So, yeah, just wonderful. She was an extraordinary woman.
Yeah.
And cultivated my interest in theater and film. And I spent so many hours of my adolescence at the Library of Performing Arts at Lincoln Center. Mm-hmm. It was a wonderful resource for me. It's funny today, you know, with everything so easily available on YouTube and on the internet, and yet I wonder whether that's, in a way, keeps young people away from really searching out information.
Oh, no doubt.
You know, my aunt gave me these big coffee table sized books of, you know, a pictorial history of the
MGM
talkies.
And all that, yes.
Yeah, a pictorial history of the American theater, great stars of the American stage. And I'd be flipping through these pictures, suddenly I'd see a photo of some woman who looked so fascinating. Eva LaGallien, let's say, or, you know, and I thought, oh, I like that picture. Who's that? And then I'd have to drag myself over to Lincoln Center, but I'd just spend hours going through old scrapbooks and absorbing the career of this person. And then looking at Eva LaGallien, I'd see another name, and that's intriguing. So then I'd go to the next one. That really was my great education, was just, you know, seeing one picture leading to another, to another, and finding another book. Well, I guess I had an equal fascination with theater and film.
Sure. Well, you know, I could see why they would go hand in hand.
It is so funny, though, when you read books of about how the golden age has passed.
Right.
I recently read a wonderful book about the history of Greenwich Village, where I live. And, as far back as 1890, people were saying, oh, Greenwich Village is finished.
Right.
Oh, just all the artists have left. It's, you know, it's just commercialized. All the way back to then. And I think, too, with Hollywood, probably by the 40s, people thought, oh, the golden age of silent film was long gone and it's all downhill. So it's cyclical.
I sure hope that you're right and the theater keeps coming back.
Well, supposedly today we're living in a golden age of dramatic television.
I was about to mention that. Now we're in the golden age of television. And it does sort of feel that way again. But then again, it was supposed to be the golden age of television in the 50s, right?
Right. But I think we're supposed to be in a golden age of dramatic series right now.
Yes.
And I don't watch any of them.
You don't have the time. You're too busy. I'm looking forward to coming. I think I'm going to be there at the evening performance on Sunday, February 8th. Again, at the 92nd Street Y. Charles Bush will be there with a bunch of, I'm sure, very talented performers, including Nancy Anderson, Andrea Burns, Katie Huffman.
Katie Huffman. She won the Tony Award for the producers.
Yeah, that I think I may have seen her in that. Aaron McGuire and Zakiya Young. Did I get that right? Or
you got it.
Oh, great.
And they do an odd schedule. It's Saturday through Monday.
Right.
So they're with several matinees. Yeah.
Yeah. So anybody can go to the 92nd Street Y website and check out the schedule. And but I'm looking forward to meeting you in person. Thanks for
doing this.
I really appreciate your spending some time. Good thing that we did record this. Thanks to me, we'll have another 15 people that will have listened and heard. no, I'm kidding. And by the way, one thing that I just wanted to mention on a personal note, which film was it that where you seem to be channeling Eve Arden? It was one of the great comedy performances. I think it was like
that I made. I think. Well, I don't know. People say that about everything I do, Eve Arden.
There is a bit of Eve Arden, right?
Die, Mommy, Die?
Or? Die, Mommy, Die. Yeah, yeah, that's the one. Right? It's not my imagination. You're definitely... And it's a good one to channel.
I'm not. I think it's just somehow my facial structure kind of resembles her a little bit or something, because she's actually not at all one of the ladies that I reference. I play different characters, so sure. it shifts, but I would say generally my screen persona is somewhere between Greer Garson and Rosalind Russell and Susan Hayward, probably more often than not.
Got it.
Yeah, but I think I in drag I choked a bit like Eve Arden, so I'll take it. There's some shoes.
That's what they used to say about Eve Arden, though. So it's fair.
Does she look like Charles Bush
in drag? Yes.
I almost met her too. It's so frustrating. We were doing a play of mine in L.A. many years ago, and there was an elderly house manager who knew a lot of these old actresses when they were, you know, still alive, and he would sometimes get them to our show. And Eve Arden was supposed to come, and then we were so excited, and I don't think she was well and canceled. So almost got bigger. Yeah,
that would have been a great photo to have. Well, I'll try to.
I'll see you after the show.
Oh, that'd be great.
Okay, I'll see you there.
Okay, thanks, Charles.
Bye, Adam.
Thanks for sticking with me so far. It's now up as the low-budget indie film called Red Right Return. Again, we're going to be sitting now with my friends George Manitos and Alexandra Clayton. And unfortunately, because of inclement weather, which I referred to at the introduction, Christopher Lenkenau could not get into New York for the Film Anthology Archive screening or my show, unfortunately. But he did Skype in, so he will be chiming in also on the conversation. Again, Red Right Return. Here's the segment.
Gonna be good friends till the very end, just me and you.
I shouldn't be worried about you, should I?
I'm gonna hold you so close, gonna love you the most, just me and you.
You weren't fucking here last summer, like he was unrecognizable.
I'm never gonna let you go. Wouldn't want you to know anyone but me.
It's a small detail. I'm not saying I've been getting high.
I'm using my intuitive sense, so you're probably doomed. I'm sorry. Anyway, we're talking about Red Right Return, which just had a screening here in New York City
last night
at the Film Anthology Archives historical place. How was that experience, George?
It was a great experience. It was a little tough with the snow. I know it deterred a lot of the would-be audience members, but it was a great experience. It was a really nice group of people over there. Really great, you know, reception and a lot of cast and crew. So. Mm-hmm. We had a fun time.
And Alexandra, I assume you were there. And,
yeah.
Yeah. And Chris would have been there, but you were snowed out, right?
Snowed out, yeah.
You're in Portland?
I am, yeah. I was supposed to leave on Monday morning, and then when I got to the airport, they basically said that no one is getting into New York after 4 p.m., and then I just kind of gave up.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
It had to be frustrating for you.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah, I don't know. Not as much as you might think.
That's well. Yeah, no. It's a big trip.
You looked good on the big screen, Chris.
Oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
George, tell me this first. Let everyone know what Red Right Return is about and who's in it and all the essentials. Let's do some housekeeping here.
Sounds good. Starring Chris Lenkenau and Leo Fitzpatrick, and they play two brothers who go away for the weekend two kind of estranged brothers who are trying to reconnect through a weekend alone at the family beach house. And Chris's character, Ian, is supposedly freshly out of rehab. And his older brother, Colin, played by Leo Fitzpatrick, is picking him up at this facility as Colin's character is about to get married. So it's kind of this juncture in both their lives, and they're trying to reconnect and become close again.
Right.
And Alexandra's character comes in later in the film. But basically, she comes in as a result of Ian inviting friends down and kind of building this party as he feels, as the younger brother, kind of like he can, you know, he can make it happen and he can be good for a weekend and not, you know, not give in to temptation for his older brother.
So. Where'd you shoot it?
We shot in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware,
okay,
and some of the surrounding areas. It's my grandmother's house is the house in the film.
How much did she ask for?
We had a lot of negotiations to bring her down.
I bet.
No, it was free in all of our locations. Actually, it's a testament to that town and how kind of receptive everybody was. But we didn't pay a cent for locations.
That's essentially the essence of independent filmmaking. Totally. Low budge independent filmmaking.
Very low budge. We're, right, you know, very small movie. And so that's kind of, I think, a big part of the reason that I wrote it there is I kind of knew at the, you know, a year and a half out from shooting, it's like you're writing and you're thinking, how can I get this made? How can I show this script to people? And part of getting money is being realistic, right? So it's like saying, here's a script, here's this thing we're going to do. And if you're saying it's a sci-fi fantasy for $50,000, you're like, people just laugh at you.
Yeah.
So we tried to do it in that one location. And, you know, Chris, at the time, we did that short film Benny to Benny together, which Filmax was nice enough to screen in 2013. Chris was kind of, I was writing, but I'd show it to Chris at every kind of stage and every juncture, and he'd give notes on it. And so Chris also had a hand in writing certain scenes. He was a part of the project the whole time. And then Alexandra came on later, but still a good kind of distance out from shooting.
So to Alexandra, how'd you get cast in this? Did you know George already? And
George came to see a film that I was in that screened at Rooftop a few years ago called I Think It's Raining. And he had a friend actually in California that was the editor for that film. So she told him to go to the screening and we hit it off. And he cast me, and then we became friends while he was still kind of building the project up. That was how we met.
And did you end up writing the part for her?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that is big for me that I'm learning, even with kind of subsequent projects, is like I'm only comfortable with so much fabrication in something. So like if I'm writing, I really prefer to write for somebody, for a personality, because it makes the, you know, dialogue authentic or something that they would say. And so at a certain point, I definitely was writing for Alexander, writing for Chris, and actually writing for Leo as well.
Well, tell me about that. And you know, and trying to find, I mean, did you see Chris and Leo would have a chemistry, a synergy? What did you know?
I mean, Chris was part of the project from so early on that I was, you know, so much of the film and its personality, I think, is Chris is rooted in that. With Alexandra, it was later. But even the character names, like Alexandra chose the character name, her character's name. Chris chose his character's name.
Okay.
That kind of thing. So that they, you know, I felt like
they had a little bit more vested in the character.
Yeah, and ownership over the character and the personality of the character and, you know, the stuff they wore and the way they talk and things like that. That inspires me. I see it as like another filter to my own, whatever I come at the film with, like a decision or a choice. It's another filter on those choices. And so with Leo, I didn't know Leo at the time when I was writing for him, but I thought it'd be interesting. Not only did I think they looked a lot alike, but I thought their personalities would kind of clash in an interesting way.
Let's go to the break room. Chris.
Yeah.
Hey, Chris.
Hi.
Chris, what was it like working with Leo? Did you guys hit it off? Because it sounds like George conceived of you two to play brothers, but I don't know did you ever meet Leo before, or did you know him, or did you ever work with him before?
I had never met him. We had some friends in common just from living in New York. And there was years before we had done the movie, I had been writing for Vice magazine, and some people that were involved with that were mutual friends of ours. And then once we started shooting, though, we kind of hit it off because he is a pretty big skateboarder. Like he's skated for years and years, and I think that's even portrayed in like Kids and shit. Mm-hmm. So we talked about that a lot, and I feel like once we sensed that the other guy was like authentic as or, like we were both skaters, then that kind of allowed us to develop a quick friendship.
Right. I guess both being skaters is like having a shorthand.
It really was, yeah. And like the reference points, you know, like they're you kind of get into this whole it's like a subculture, you know. So it's like right. You recognize that the other guy is in there with you, and that you guys are sort of different, or you're in this exclusive little club. Trust me, it's a lot cooler than I'm making it sound. But
well, that's one thing I was going to say real quick is that there was a chemistry with Chris and Leo that was apparent from day one that I thought, you know, I was kind of terrified of that, because it's like if you don't sell that they're brothers, you lose your audience.
Yeah.
And so that was really important to me. And Leo, I think casting wise, choosing him, that he's always cast as kind of this tough, kind of, you know, roughnecky guy. And I think casting him as this responsible older brother against type was really
another risk.
Yeah, it was a risk, but I like, you know, I think that was in, yeah. With a film this size, it's like taking risks is what makes it fun.
Sorry, I'm a little scattered. It's not you.
It's cool.
Once you start going to therapy, your ability to make conversation, even with, you know, family, it's hard.
Yeah. I mean, there's some times where I'm jealous. You know, I wish I could go to therapy. I wish I had that kind of time.
I guess if it works, I don't know. It's harder than it sounds. I'm doing a bad job of describing it, I think.
Like, for me, Emily is the only person I've told certain things to, you know, maybe besides you. The other day, when I was packing, Emily, she was going on about how much she likes you and she cares about you, and she wants you to know that. You do know that, right?
I guess I feel like I'm just a different person than I was, I don't know, like as little as 6 months ago.
That's because you are. You ready?
Don't listen to me, man. It doesn't matter what I think.
No, yes, it does.
And Leo, who has been on this podcast, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For which?
For Eric the Talks, he kind of has this Muppety sound. You notice that when he talks? He kind of has a Muppety little... No? Should
never
do that?
Noticed that, no.
Oh. I am Leo Fitzpatrick, the actor.
But I will say...
An artist.
Yes, I got a slice of pizza in the city the other day, and his picture was up on the wall with the sound guy from Red Right Return. And we were like sitting down to eat our pizza, and we were like, "Whoa!"
Well, plug the pizza.
Hey,
where was the pizza place?
By Elizabeth Street.
Uh-huh.
And it was in Elizabeth and Prince.
That's probably pretty close to his gallery, right?
Maybe.
I think so.
They had him on the wall.
Yeah.
It cracked us up.
Yeah, but he's notoriously can be difficult, right? I don't think anybody. I think he'd like almost probably enjoy that being described as that. But maybe, case, Chris? Chris, be honest here. Leo, was he great on the set, or was he sometimes just, you know, what was he like?
I thought he was never difficult towards me. We got along like. More in a friendly way than in like a professional, you know. I feel like when we were, you know, during the day when we were still shooting, it was a little more had that more professional vibe. But like, there was a couple nights when I would stay there was like a designated actor house, and then one where the kind of crew stayed, and I would usually stay at the crew house. And but I think there were two nights total where I stayed with Leo at the actor house, and it was awesome. We would stay up late, and he would, like, you know, drink beer, and it was great. Yeah.
Right. Then on top of that, you think, what's missing? Oh, I know. I'll cast Arnor Tekel.
Yes.
Who comes up in every fucking episode of this podcast at least once. It must be, like, just contractual or something. Of course, I understand. Everybody wants Owner. He's also hilarious. He's
just, like, yeah, he brings this energy that's just so interesting. And I mean, Owner's a friend, and so like he was a part of the project from the very beginning, just in a supportive fellow filmmaker way.
Sure, but sure.
Bringing him in, just even though he's not in much of the film, he adds such a really, to me, like that character, played by a lot of people, would have been, it's a small role, would bring this kind of like play it
he's
safe.
One of the buddies that...
And he doesn't play it safe, and that's what I wanted, is someone who would come on. And, like, you know, a lot of what made it in the film wasn't anticipated or written in, but him, like, there's a scene where he's chugging a beer, and he gets upset that he didn't win the beer chugging contest, and he starts screaming at a friend. But it's like, that's the kind of shit that Owner brings to a project that, like, makes it interesting.
Right, because those are people we know, too, right? It's hard to write that.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Alex.
The party scene was actually really fun. It was shot overnight. Starting, I don't know, at 9 p.m. and kind of going all night. I mean, much to the fun for us actors, George actually let us party all night. And, like, we were drinking beers, and and Owner was awesome. I mean, he kept it going all night long.
Like, he's good for that.
He's like, party? You like to party? Who wants to party? And it was like, by
what
3 in the morning,
like
he was still
60,
there.
You know? same, I think.
So,
same guy.
He was, like, very good in setting the tone and keeping everybody else, like, on that high energy level. So every little party snippet was sincere, and we were really having fun.
That's good. And how long was the shoot?
The total, we shot for 14 days, I think.
Wow. That is brief, huh?
It's brief.
But I think, I'm sure.
In the Q&A last night, they asked, like, what we'd do differently next time. That's what I said is, I didn't feel rushed, really, to be honest, with this project, because we were mainly in one location. But I think next project, just like learning what, you know, every time you learn something, and like I think using time differently would be more fun. It's like having an extra just 3 days would have been a blast in terms of getting those like variables, those like while you're moving, you see things and you hear things that are great. So,
and hey, Chris, I'm sorry, I unmuted you.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. I'm glad you're still there. And it got quieter in the break room.
It did.
Yeah. Oh, so when, I understand, George, that, of course, what a beautiful house, your grandmother's beach house. It's free. Mm-hmm. It's big enough to sleep everybody and to contain a set for the film. But do you have everything you need? Like, or how far are you if there's like some sort of problem or you run out of something or something malfunctions? I mean, when you're working... You
it
know,
was a little more difficult.
Yeah.
We had a camera body issue that, we, you know, at the time, there were like 8 camera bodies in the entire United States.
Yeah.
It was a very specific camera. But we had it shipped from L.A., and it was, you know, it was different.
What was it?
It was called the Iconoscope. It was Iconoscope. This Swedish camera.
Wow. Why'd you go for that?
You know...
You don't have an answer.
I do have an answer. It's a really long answer, but I'm trying to make it succinct.
Okay.
It basically is a very organic digital camera, and... Chris Mawson, our DP, he and I really kind of commiserate about how clean video looks. You know, it's getting to the point where it's, you know, obviously it's past the point of an option versus film, and it is the option, you know, but things look too clean and too prepared.
Right.
And we wanted things to have that feeling of, you know, like almost nostalgic kind of like homemade feeling. And that's hard to do with digital.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of warmth of that chemical process, that's the camera that gave it to us, I think.
That's a great answer. And it didn't take that long either.
Thanks.
No, because I started reading some different things, and I'm like, it's now I'm understanding the actual, like, you know, when you're creating a set, I mean, yeah, you decide to shoot somewhere a little bit more remote and something happens, you know, you can get in trouble. And so I'm just trying to kind of like filmmaker that maybe starting off, they can learn a lot from that experience, or just take it into account. It's not like don't do that, because that's insane
and minuses,
not to
for
do
sure.
that. Yeah.
Because like the minuses of being in a town like that is everyone's excited to bring you to their bar or their restaurant and let you shoot for free, whereas it's not that way in New York.
No.
But there are minuses of like, you have to work a little harder as far as communication and things like that.
Right.
Yeah. But everyone was so supportive in that town. I think the cast and crew all had fun in that town too.
Oh, good.
It's very charming. There's like an arcade.
Right, yeah.
There's some old carnival rides.
It was shot in the summer, right?
Stunning beach.
Spring, okay.
Like
before the season?
Lookout towers from World War II.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just awesome.
Really?
It was awesome. So like, but if you weren't needed on set. You could go walk the beach, walk to town, get a hot dog.
Yeah, that does sound really nice.
It was really fun.
Yeah, and it was warm, so it was still warm, but it was not the height of the season either, so that was good.
Yeah.
So you could actually, like...
Like a light leather jacket in Europe.
Oh, that is nice.
Doing fine. Yeah.
That's basically it.
That was lovely.
Thanks. There would be more, like, voice cracks and more yelping sounds. I was still kind of halfway through puberty, so...
How old?
I don't know, like early teens, 13.
It's about your brother also? My dad calls people like that skeeters.
Like what?
Skeeter. Like, you know, like the bugs on top of the pond, a little like shoot around all day, searching and searching and just kind of stay on the surface and never really stick their head underneath the water. I don't know if they choose to be that way, or some of us need to be that way, or they're designed that way, or they're too afraid to be another way. I'm definitely adding the last part. I'm making that up. I'm just rambling now. I don't know. It was a great song, though.
Okay, so now tell me, and you can talk about as much or as little as you feel comfortable, but the festival experience has been a challenge, right?
A bit, yeah.
A little bit?
Yeah.
Did it pick up some steam or something, or did you... I mean, the Film Anthology, by the way, is great.
That's great. I mean, that was nice. There. I mean, we played...
Series, right? What was the name of the series?
New Filmmakers at Anthology, yeah. So that's our second screening. Our first was a sneak preview at the Rehoboth Independent Film Festival. Yeah, you know, it's hard with a film that size, but I think especially, and I don't know, I mean, I'm way too close to it, so I don't know really how to answer this, but being such a quiet, subtle film, I think isn't an easy sell, you know? And we're not exactly a film that comes out of the gate screaming, so you know the process that people watch the first half hour of a film, and if it doesn't strike a chord, if your chord that you want to strike with them is 45 minutes in, it's a lot harder. So that's the way I feel about it, but, you know, we're still hopeful.
I do have to say it is a film that does so beautifully on the big screen. And last night was the first night that I had seen it on a big screen.
Really?
And it felt like almost a different film to me because
there's
a really nuanced soundscape.
Right.
And it's like these really subtle emotional shifts between the two brothers that you're watching and actually like getting to see it full size and have the sound surround you. You really get to like... delve into the journey in a way I hadn't experienced. So,
yeah. Hey, Chris, have you gotten to see the film on a large screen yet?
I have not. I've only seen it, you know, like on a laptop.
Yeah, we'll have to fix that soon.
Yeah,
I know.
Or doesn't Portland have a festival? Sure.
I'm sure they must. Yeah, but yeah, I don't know.
I'm sure they've got right.
They must. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I know of a Portland. There's definitely a Portland International, right?
Piff? Not a great name. Portland, if you're listening, let's go to the phones. I feel like Larry King all the time. Portland. Chris, any other thoughts? Any other feelings about the experience of working with George or and Alexandra? And any memories that you want to share in particular? Or
well, I was going to say before when you guys were talking about submitting to all the festivals and stuff that. In my experience, which was very limited, you know, in the two films that I had done before this one, everything seemed so kind of effortless. And I guess it was because I was involved with filmmakers who had already done their first movie and kind of gotten that step that we were at out of the way. Like, I think it is so much of a challenge when you have your first film and yeah, like, I guess, you know, George and I had worked on a short, but for it to be your first feature, I think it probably is really tough, and I'm sure he can attest to this, to get recognized or get anybody to kind of give you a shot, because there is, you know, there's nothing else to, I don't know, it just seems like a hard thing to break into, and, you know, before in the films that I had done previously, people had already done that. So it was like, oh, this is how it works. You just make a movie and then it plays all over the place. And you know, it's an easy, it's a really easy, like, sell. You know, it's not.
Yes,
I guess,
of course, once you build up the festival momentum, I understand. Yeah.
Right. And, yeah, I don't know. So I guess, it wasn't surprising. It was just like, oh, like, it's, I just thought, like, oh, it's not that easy. Like, that's. I had no idea that, you know, just having a one movie behind you already made such a huge difference, you know.
Sure. Yeah, as a matter of fact, Chris, as you talk about it, now I think about it, one usually refers to a filmmaker's first film, and they're wrong. Like, before, you know, Stranger Than Paradise, oh, Jim Jarmusch had made another film, Permanent Vacation. But you don't know that until they've made a bigger success and that, oh, they had a first film. But, you know, I'm sure Permanent Vacation played Film Anthology Archives, in fact, probably before it had any other exposure. And Chris Langenau, and of course, was in Cold Weather.
Quiet City.
Two Aaron Katz films.
Yeah.
Right? So very good casting on your part on all three actors. Four, including Orner, of course. I don't know the other people in it, but you know what I like about it, why I, you know, other than I feel like a personal connection with you, George, is that it just puts you in this place and it feels completely authentic for that 80 minutes or whatever long it is. Like, you just felt like you're watching a real authentic piece of filmmaking, and I'm not expecting some great arc or some everybody come out being, you know, somehow, you know, changed in some sort of, you know, major fashion. But, you know, it just, it feels like you're there and it feels real. And that to me is price of admission. And I would like to wait to see it on the big screen. I would like to have that opportunity. So I hope it does get that opportunity. You know. So what about, what about distributing it online? As for, you know, also so people can see it, like if they...
Yeah, that's a route, you know, we would love to go. Uh-huh. We've been in contact with a few distributors, mm-hmm. but, you know, nothing concrete yet.
Okay.
But, yeah.
We'll keep in touch with you guys about that.
Great.
So the name of the film is Red Right Return. It's George Manitos'.
Bit of a tongue twister.
It is, but it's a hook. And what's the term? It's alliterative.
Deport after being out at sea?
No, alliterative is when all the words start with the same letter.
Alliteration.
Alliteration. Well, we'll make sure we figure out a way to get it so people can see it too sooner than later. So people, you know, we can. I think that people are probably frustrated now. They're like, "Boy, where can I see this movie?" So we got to make that available to them.
Let's hope.
Okay. Thank you, guys. Thank you, Chris.
Oh, my pleasure.
And thank you, Alexandra. Lovely to see you.
My pleasure too.
And George.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. And hopefully, Chris, you'll be in New York soon, sooner than later.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good enough. Okay, good. Now I know you mean it.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Chris.
Sure.
Hey, everybody. So thanks for listening. I implore you go to iTunes and give us a star rating right now. Go on. It takes just a moment or two. Go ahead. Do it. Do me a kindness. Okay. Go and give us a star rating. Leave a comment, too. But more importantly, just put a star rating in. And if you're not subscribed, of course, you want to subscribe. We're still on the Facebook page, which is facebook.com/filmwaxradio. We're still under 1,000 likes. How is that even possible? I don't know. But I know there are more than 1,000 people that listen to the show. We have tens of thousands who have listened to the show. Not that they listen every episode. I wish that were the case, but the numbers are moving up. I'm finally calming down about it. But I need your help. So and for me to get more sponsors, for me to get more visibility for the show, what I'm trying to do, for me to get a wider range of guests, I need your help. And subscribing is the best way you can do it. And I'm not even asking for any money. I'm sure that day will come. But I would love to have a studio. I would love to do all those things. But I can do it pretty much on my own, I believe. You know, I just need to get some help here. And again, the best way you can do it is free of charge.
subscribe, and let everybody you know about the podcast. And you can write in at adam@filmwax.com, or you can write in right on the, I think on the about page, there is a, of filmwaxradio.com, there is a form, and people are using it. You can write in and suggest a guest, or just send in something, you know, comment about, you know, or your suggestions or comments, criticism, whatever. Send me a note. I can also be reached directly at adam@filmwax.com. So feel free to do that if you feel so inclined. But again, really, just go to iTunes, subscribe, and leave a star rating and do that. And like our Facebook page. And we are, of course, tweeting at Filmwax Radio. At Filmwax Radio, I mean to say. You know, you get it. That's about it, guys. We'll be back in a few days with another episode. I appreciate it. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you, everybody. This is your host, Adam Chartoff. The name of the show, again, is Filmwax Radio. It's presented by our friends over at Rooftop Films. Take care.
Adieu, Emil, my trusted friend. We've known each other since we were 9 or 10. Together we climbed hills and trees, learned of love and ABCs, skinned our hearts and skinned our knees. Adieu, Emil, it's hard to die when all the birds are singing in the sky. Now that the spring is in the air, pretty girls are everywhere. Wish for me and I'll be there. We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons and the sun. But the wine and the song, like the seasons, have all gone. Adieu, papa, please.